Hello, everybody. What's up? We're back. We are in a Blink of Fort recording studio in a one-bedroom apartment in North Hollywood, and that means that this is People Pleaser, and I am Austin Archer, and hello, and welcome back. And it's another episode where it's just me. We did one of those last week, and I thought, let's just do another one. Let's just do another one. I'm on a roll. I got shit I want to talk about. We brought back the Bad Take Brigade last week, and I thought, you know what's fun is when I do an episode that's all Bad Take Brigade. That's all just, it's just like, let's just talk about bad takes that are existing out in the world and why they're bad, and let's break them down. Lion Richardson is here on YouTube with a massive all caps, let's go. We got people, over on TikTok watching. We got a nice crowd over here. Othnelia just said, this is crazy. You're the one who made me download TikTok. Wow. Hopefully I can be the one who makes you get off of TikTok and follow me on YouTube, because TikTok might get banned anyway, and you should come over and follow me on YouTube. That's the place. That's the place you should be, because YouTube has everything that TikTok has. All of the content that I do on TikTok also goes to YouTube, but it just has more. There's just more stuff going on over at YouTube, because I even do the I have videos of the live streams of podcasts in case you've missed an episode, and I have YouTube exclusive video essays. It's all going on over at YouTube these days. That's the place to be. But we've got some stuff to do on the Bad Take Brigade. We've got some stuff to break down, so let's get into it. It's down the Bad Take Brigade. That's the theme song for it that I still have not just gone and recorded. And I found out, I was just in Vegas with a bunch of friends over the weekend, and I found out I could probably do it with an AI in 2 seconds. I could jump on an AI song creator and be like, make me a hard rock sounding stinger for this segment that I do on my podcast called The Bad Take Brigade. And I don't want to. I'm going to keep doing it a cappella, because that's what I want to do, and I don't want an AI song, but I could, and it would probably be pretty damn good, okay? We were in Vegas, and I found out about Henry McDonald. You guys know about Henry McDonald, obviously. Everyone seems to know about it but me, and my friends were teasing me, and they had an AI make a theme song to Henry McDonald, and it was pretty good. It made it in, like, a few minutes, and it was really kind of fire. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. That's not what we're talking about. I just got on that tangent because I was talking about the Bad Take Brigade theme song. Bow, bow, the Bad Take Brigade could be so easily made. I could so easily make that, and I don't. I just keep singing it poorly every time we do this segment on the show. Let's do it. First up on the Bad Take Brigade, we are going to look at Christy Noem? I don't know how to say her last name, and I don't care to find out. It doesn't really matter. Christy Noem. Noem, Gnome, whatever. This Republican who killed her dog and wrote about it in a book because she was ostensibly, what we would assume is she was trying to tell a story about how she's not afraid to do hard things. She's a candidate that you can rely on to do difficult things and to make difficult decisions and to put herself in uncomfortable positions because she can stomach it. She's done it throughout her life. So she wrote this whole story about how she shot a puppy in the face because she didn't like it. And she thought that was like a story that was going to endear her to voters, that she was like, yeah, this is, I'm tough. Because, you know, a thing that people have to do from time to time is euthanize animals. It's something we do. It is, like, this is an interesting story because it is true that we do this, that we, like, put animals down and that we put animals out of their misery. And sometimes, even if there's an animal that just, like, can't stop biting people or hurting people, we go, like, I think this animal can't be alone or alive anymore. And, you know, if an animal gets hurt and it's suffering and it's not going to recover, we do that. If a horse breaks its leg and the leg won't heal and the horse is just going to have a broken leg for the rest of its life, we put horses down. And also, I mean, we're a species that just runs food mills of living creatures, and we just raise them to be put into slaughterhouses and put on conveyor belts and just killed in horrific ways. So, like, you know, it's a little weird for us as a species to get super sanctimonious and self-righteous about this woman who's just like, hey, I shot a dog in the face. And we're like, you're an awful person, because we kill animals all the time. So it is a little weird, but it's just the context and the details I really do believe matter. I really do believe that there is a difference between saying my dog is very old and has cancer and lots of tumors, and the doctors say there's nothing we can really do. We could do a bunch of invasive surgeries that might work, and maybe we'll give my dog another year or a year and a half of life, but there's no guarantee that it will work, and it could be very costly and very painful for the dog. And maybe we should just say the dog lived for 13 years, and that's a pretty reasonable lifespan for a dog, and we sadly let the dog go and put it down. That's one thing. And what this woman did does seem to be on another level of just sort of like taking a situation into her hands where she was like, I don't like this dog, and she just took it out in the yard and shot it in the face and then wrote about it. And she was like, yeah, I didn't like the dog. like her own story is just that she was trying to teach this very young dog, this puppy, how to be a hunting dog, and it was having a hard time keeping up with the older, better trained dogs, because of course it was younger and had not been properly trained yet, and it was still just kind of figuring out how to do shit. And she, like, these are some quotes from her book that she wrote. She wrote that the dog was ruining a hunting trip by going, quote, out of her mind with excitement, chasing all those birds and having the time of her life. What an asshole dog. Also, there was a story about how the dog, like, attacked some chickens in somebody's yard and killed the chickens. Dogs kill birds. It's a thing they do, especially young dogs, and they think it's, like, in their DNA to be like, I will present this bird to my owner and say, look how good of a job I did shaking it until its neck broke. Again, pretty weird of humans to like judge a dog for killing a chicken. We kill chickens. We do that. And also dogs just kill birds. But because this dog was ruining her hunting trip and killed a few chickens, she wrote in her book, I hated that dog. It was untrainable, dangerous to anyone she came in contact with, and less than worthless as a hunting dog. And then she talked about just taking it out in her yard and shooting it. It is a puppy. And the reason why she said it was dangerous is because it killed those chickens. And that it was uncontrollable because of that. It's like, you know, I don't know. So many people have pets at their homes right now, cats and dogs, who have who are killing mice and birds and stuff, and they're not like, this dog can't be trusted. This dog is killing things and bringing them to my doorstep. I gotta put it down. I get it. Humans kill animals. It's something we do, and so it feels a little weird to start parsing out when it's cool to kill an animal and when it's not. A very reasonable argument could be made that humans just need to stop killing animals so willy-nilly. Point, like, period, that we need to be a little more, like, you know, we need to do a better job of not just killing animals whenever we want. I think there could be a very reasonable argument made there. But I think in general, we all tend to agree that, like, if you get a dog, you get a puppy, and it turns out to not be the kind of dog you want, it's not super cool to just go and leave that dog in the gutter, or like wrap that dog in a bag and throw it in a trash can or something. The better choice would be like, maybe you need to take this dog to foster care. Maybe you need to find a new home for this dog. There are other things you could do. It does seem like the dog was young enough that she could have continued to try to train it. And maybe the dog just didn't need to be a hunting dog. How about that? Maybe it's just like, this dog's not going to be a good addition to our hunting team, but that's okay. Our daughter likes the dog, and this dog can just hang out at home and just play with the kids and be a fun dog to play fetch with. But no, Christy Gnome said, nah, fuck that dog. And she shot it in the face. And she also tells a story of like how in the same day she shot this goat in the face and she missed, and like it wounded the goat but didn't kill it, and she was out of shells, so she had to go to her car and get another shell and come back and kill the dog, and that these like construction workers were watching her do that and they like looked horrified. And I think she was telling this story to be like, yeah, dude, I don't care. I'll kill an animal if it needs to be killed. And it just kind of wound up making her look like a psychopath and look like she kind of like doesn't have normal feelings. So, Christy Noam don't kill puppies because they're acting like puppies. Maybe. Brian Bunker on YouTube says, John Wick started a whole ass series of movies because they killed his dog, and America resoundingly agreed, murder spree okay. And yeah, I think that that's where we're sort of at specially, is that we all agree. It's like, hey, sometimes we put animals down, sometimes we euthanize animals, but usually we should do it as an act of kindness, as an act of, you know, helping that animal get out of a painful existence. But if it's just because, like, I don't like this dog, I think most people are like, no. Well, that's kind of our big rule, is like, don't, you know, there was that documentary, Don't Fuck with Cats. Like, don't, that guy was killing cats and filming it and putting them in bags and throwing them away. And people were like, I don't like this guy. And then he wound up killing people because he was a sociopath. And that's, I don't know if you've ever seen Don't Fuck with Cats. You watch it at your own risk, but it's a pretty good true crime documentary. But it starts off with the guy just willy-nilly killing cats. Somebody said about Kristi Noem, somebody said that she's Jeffrey Dahmer with veneers. I thought that was a really good quote, to be like, hey, she's trying to be in politics, but she's Jeffrey Dahmer with veneers. Like, she's out here just kind of willy-nilly killing animals and not really feeling any way about it. And that's sort of how it reads when she writes about it, is that it's like, yeah, sometimes you got to make hard decisions and you got to do hard things, but you should feel something. You should feel some kind of like, no, it wasn't easy. But she's like, I don't care. I'll shoot a dog right now. Like, I'll shoot anyone's dog. Bring me a dog, I'll shoot it. She's like a little too excited about it. Okay, Kristi Noem, that's the first one. This second one, second person up, second people up. This is a group of people. This is just a generalized group of people on the Bad Take Brigade. And this is something that this is sort of cyclical throughout history. We see this every few years, time and time and time again, we get a chance to look at this. And every time it happens, I just sort of scratch my head like, were you all not there the last time we did this? We did this. There's so many things like this. I had to make a video recently that was like pro-abortion. I had to talk about reproductive rights for a video. And as I was writing the video, I was just like, aren't we tired of this? Like, aren't we tired of the same old arguments again and again and again? We've already done it. We've made all these points so many times, in so many ways, in so many different conversations, at so many different periods throughout history. Why do we keep having to do it? And that's what this one revolves around. This is people, this next person on the Bad Take Brigade, this is people, this might be you, it's anyone out there who doesn't seem to understand what protesting is and how protesting works and how civil disobedience works whenever mass protests break out. This happens every single time. Every single time there's some mass protest over a thing, there's always like a very loud group of people who are like, hold on, I was watching on the news and they're like taking up public space and they're kind of getting rowdy in there. They're like pushing and shoving with police. And I even saw like some windows got broken. I mean, hey, I'm all for protests, but they gotta cool it if they want people to respect their cause. And it's just sort of every single time this happens, I'm like, hey, have you never seen one of these things before? Is this the first time in your life that you've ever seen civil disobedience before as an act of political resistance and so, you know, political activism? Are you completely unaware of what a protest is? It seems like these people, every single time this happens, are like, what you're supposed to do is schedule some time with the city when you can go to a place and sit there and hold signs. And then if the police show up and say, you can't be here, you gotta leave, you say, so sorry, we will go home, and you pack your cars up and you leave. And that's how they did it back in the civil rights era in the 60s. That's how it went down. Is they'd have their permits ready to go. And if the police said, hey, it's time to get out of here, they'd say, say no more, officers. Thank you for letting us be here for a few hours. We will be on our way. And that's how protests work. That's how all of the revolutions in France have worked. That's how you get it done. That's what they did in Tiananmen Square. That's what a protest is. It's really, really weird. It's really, really weird to me every single time mass protest breakout that we have to have the same conversation about, like, what protesting is and why violence sometimes happens at protests. Almost every single time, it's the same reason. It's usually a group of peaceful protesters who are occupying a space, whether they have permission to or not. The part of civil disobedience is to say, we are going to put our bodies in the way of whatever is happening in this space. We are going to interrupt what is happening in this space and occupy this space, whether we're legally allowed to or not. That's the disobedience part of civil disobedience. But we're going to do it without fighting anyone. And usually what happens is the bulldogs of the state, the enforcers of the state, the enforcers of the political elite, the police, show up and start throwing tear gas at people and shooting rubber bullets at people and hitting people with batons and slamming people into the pavement and zip tying them and spraying them with bear mace. And as a result of that, some people fight back. They say, no, you can't do that. You're like, you can't treat us like that while we're just standing here trying to say we want our tax dollars to stop funding genocide. You can't grab us and slam us and put your knee on our neck and zip tie us and spray us with bear mace. We're not going to tolerate that. And that's why sometimes these things get violent. They don't ever need to. Protests could be entirely peaceful. They might be a little annoying, a little obnoxious. They might be taking up space, maybe a little inconvenient, but they don't usually need to break out in property damage or violence. They usually do when police show up or when counter protesters show up. So, you know, when the Black Lives Matter protests were happening in the wake of George Floyd and during, you know, the pandemic and people were marching in the streets, a lot of times what would happen is Proud Boys and conservative demonstrators, you know, white nationalists would show up at the, you know, All Lives Matter crowd would show up at these protests, would drive their cars through the protests, would get out and start agitating protesters, bringing weapons to peaceful areas and beating people and hitting people, and the crowds would fight back. But it was outside agitators coming in to make the protest look bad. And that's exactly what's happening on these college campuses, is pro-Israel counter-protesters are showing up and being aggressive and being the aggressors toward nonviolent, peaceful, pro-Palestine protesters. And the enforcers of the state, the police, are showing up and being doing what police do and being unnecessarily brutal and violent with the protesters. And so what happens as a result of that is, yeah, some windows might get broken, some people might get knocked over, some skulls might get cracked, and that's what happens. That's what civil disobedience can look like. What doesn't get covered in the news pretty much ever when mass civil disobedience and mass protest breaks out is the fact that the vast majority of demonstrations like this are entirely peaceful. Nobody gets hurt. Nothing gets broken. If no counter-protesters show up to pick a fight and throw stuff into the crowd, if no police start swinging batons and spraying bear mace, usually stuff can go pretty smoothly. I've been to so many demonstrations in my life where we were allowed to occupy public space, allowed to walk through the streets and block traffic, and no violence broke out because it didn't need to. We were allowed to demonstrate. We were allowed to do the thing we were doing. We were there to do, even though the thing we were there to do might have been a little inconvenient, might have been a little, you know, obtrusive. There's no reason that anyone needs to drive a car through the crowd. There's no reason that anybody needs to start throwing haymakers. There's no reason that anybody needs to get sprayed with bear mace or slammed into the pavement. But when that starts happening, that's when violence breaks out, and that's what you see in the media. But boy, it sure is wild that just every single time we do this, we have to go through like a history lesson of what protests look like, what protests are, what civil disobedience looks like, that it's not just this super convenient thing where, you know, where no one's day is interrupted or ruined in any kind of way. And the frustrating thing about it is, for a lot of people, there's no right way to do it. People will get mad when windows get broken, and those same people will be mad when athletes are kneeling quietly during the national anthem. And it really demonstrates that there is no mode of protestation that people like that will actually accept as legitimate. It doesn't matter how quiet, how unobtrusive, how inoffensive the protest is, they will find a reason why it's inappropriate and why it's not being done the proper way. The reality of it is, a protest is not really intended to be convenient or necessarily nice or respectful. It's meant to be noticed. It's meant to be disruptive. That's sort of the whole idea of it. Another thing that will happen is people will criticize protests. And again, this is just throughout history. Anytime this happens, people will criticize protests for being imperfect. There will be people who are on the correct side of a protest whose behavior is maybe not the most helpful or the most informed. There's a lot of people that show up to these things. There's a lot of people that want to be involved and want to be on the right side of history for the right kind of cause. And every once in a while, people in those crowds will start slogans or chants that aren't particularly useful, or will also have ideas that are sort of antithetical or counterproductive to the cause. A protest is never going to be perfect. It's a group, especially a protest like this where it's breaking out on college campuses. These are like young people who are trying to be politically active, who know that they care about the thing that they're protesting in service of, that they're trying to advocate for, but who are going to misstep from time to time. And people will kind of throw the entire reason for the protest out, throw the baby out with the bathwater because they can find some flaws. Natalie Wynn, who I love, who is the queen of the internet and who can do no wrong and is always right about everything, wrote something really brilliant on Twitter about this that I am just going to read at you right now. She wrote, "Student activism is never perfect. You'll always find some protesters who are ignorant or overzealous or narcissistic. They're like 19 years old. But you also can't wait for the perfect protest. It will never come. I really do empathize with the difficult position of left-wing Jews who support the ceasefire, but are also wounded by protesters saying ignorant or anti-Semitic shit like Israelis go back to Europe. The average U.S. college student is probably not aware that most Israeli Jews are Mizrahi or Sephardi and not in any sense from Europe. They're probably not aware of a lot of things, and sometimes their rhetoric is tone deaf or worse. Those protesters should be educated and corrected. But the central purpose of the protests is to address an urgent humanitarian crisis. Many students are bravely risking police violence to speak out. So obsessing over their occasional broken window or the occasional broken window or offensive slogan seems to me like a warped sense of priorities." Boom, Natalie Wynn. Brava, brava. Thank you, Queen. Thank you for that brilliant tweet. Brilliant. And that's all that needs to be said is like, yeah, people are going to fuck up. Like, people are going to say the wrong things. People are going to accidentally stray into ignorance. People aren't going to have all of the necessary information, but they have enough information to know that what they're witnessing is not okay. To know that to be able to see the clearly lopsided nature of what's taking place. To be able to watch time and time again as Israel, herds people into areas that they call safe zones and then bombs those safe zones. They know enough to be able to remember that when all of this first happened, there was a whole lot of hullabaloo over whether or not Israel had bombed a hospital. Like, the first hospital that got bombed, there was all this like stuff about like, no, that's fake news, you know, like that's Hamas propaganda. Israel would never bomb a hospital. That didn't happen. And now here we are 6 months later, and there are no hospitals left. They've all been bombed. And people can witness this, and they don't need to know every single detail of the entire history of the conflict to understand that, to understand the incongruity there, and to be able to to understand that, like, when Israeli leaders say our goal is complete annihilation and the complete elimination of the Palestinian people, and to firmly establish an Israeli state in Gaza and to completely eradicate these people, they can understand what that means. It doesn't require a lot of you don't need to have your degree to understand that that is what genocide is. My friend Charles McBride said something on Threads today that I liked. He said, it's crazy that one of the most common arguments from Zionists against what's happening being a genocide is that it's an incomplete genocide. And that's so accurate. So often you'll hear from people that they'll be like, if it was a genocide, more people would be dead. And it's like, yeah, it's like, it doesn't need to be finished for it to be a genocide. Just like January 6th didn't need to be successful for it to be an attempted coup. That was the same argument that people used during January 6th was they were like, if it had been a coup, then we would have overthrown the government. It's like, well, you were trying to. You were there to do that. That's what they went there to do. They went there with the express purpose of overthrowing the government and our democratic process and assassinating several politicians on both sides of the aisle. They did not succeed, but that doesn't mean that that's not what they were doing. And that's the same way with what's happening in Gaza. It's like, just because they're not finished with the genocide doesn't mean it's not a genocide. But yeah, I love what Natalie says there, that it's like, hey, some of these kids are going to misspeak. I'm going to fucking misspeak. Natalie's probably going to misspeak. We're all going to make the occasional slip up. It is a warped sense of priorities to use that as a way to dismiss the larger issue of the pressing and urgent humanitarian crisis that requires our attention and our devotion. That's, you know, people who don't understand what protesting is. Stop it. Get what protests are. Understand that sometimes violence happens at them. It's not always the fault of the people who are protesting. It often isn't. It's often the fault of the police. And understand that. Staying on the same topic, the next people up on the Bad Take Brigade are pro-Israel counter-demonstrators throwing massive fireworks into the protest camps at UCLA and beating pro-Palestine activists with weapons that they carried into the camps, and the LAPD for letting them do this completely unchecked. This was just sort of wild behavior from pro-Israeli counter-protesters to show up at a peacefully occupied plot of land by pro-Palestine protesters and say, you know how we're going to make ourselves look better on the world stage is by throwing explosives at these people who are just sort of chilling on this plot of grass and bringing sticks and weapons to beat them with and to try to, you know, brutally attack them. That's how we're going to sort of make sure that everyone knows we're the good guys. I watched the footage of this happening, and it's an astonishing level. It's an astonishing lack of self-awareness that I see. That's like, I don't understand how these people aren't aware that on the world stage right now and in the eyes of history currently, they look horrendous. They couldn't look worse. They do not look good right now at all. Israel looks terrible right now. The actions of the Israeli government and the Israeli military have just been horrendous over, you know, I mean, really for decades now, but this last campaign over the last, you know, since October 7th has just been disgusting every single day, just disgusting displays of brutality. And to be a person who thinks that this brutality is justified and is righteous and is good, and who feels like you will be vindicated one day in the eyes of history, that the history books will recognize you as the person who was fighting for what is right. It's got to tell you something if you're showing up at a place where people are like standing their ground in a nonviolent way, just occupying a plot of land, and you go there with the express purpose of throwing explosives at them and beating them with sticks and trying to violently silence them. I don't know. I gotta imagine that, like, if that's the team that I was on, I would want that to ping some kind of flag in my conscience and in my brain that, like, I don't know, we feel, this feels weird. This feels weird to me to be on this side of things. I understand that indoctrination runs deep. It's really, really tough, man. It's really, really tough. People are so deep in this. It's part of their DNA. It's part of their culture and their heritage. It's part of their family. It's everything that they know. And it's really, really hard to say, we need you to unprogram all of that really, really quick and understand that, like, you're advocating for the wrong side of things here. But oftentimes they're showing up at these places and they are beating people who are also Jewish. There are so many anti-Zionist Jews who are at these protests who are supporting the cause, the pro-Palestinian cause, and who want a free Palestinian state. And they are, they're throwing explosives at these people. And so, it is a lack of self-awareness. It is an inability to self-reflect. We talked about self-reflection last week on the podcast, and this, it just shows kind of a dire inability to self-reflect. So often when I watch these people and their behavior and the way that it's so disingenuous, the way that they'll use this talking point of like, anyone who's at these protests is a part of Hamas. You are Hamas. They're calling that these children, these kids, these college kids, they're calling them terrorists as they're beating them with sticks. They're saying, you know, get out of here, terrorists and stuff. And it's like, it's a level of self-deception. You are deceiving yourself. You are adopting something that you don't actually believe to be true in order to justify your position and your behavior. And it's really sad. It's really hard to watch. I made a video about this recently about how conservative people will often adopt or pretend to adopt beliefs in order to support positions that they hold that they don't actually believe in, just so that they don't have to yield any ground. I was talking to this person about guns. I made a video about gun violence and about how, you know, guns are used to kill children all the time in America. And this person wrote, well, that's not the purpose of guns. And I was like, what do you mean it's not the purpose of guns? That's what guns are for. Guns exist to kill people. That's what a gun is. And the person was like, sure, whatever. They said, okay, buddy. That's how they responded. They said, okay, buddy. And I went, sorry, you have to enlighten me here. If a gun is not intended to kill people, what is it intended for? What is the primary purpose of a gun if that's not it? And this person responded that the primary purpose for guns is sport, like shooting clay pigeon and pigeons and shooting competitions, like rifle competitions and stuff like that. And I was like, that's just so crazy. You're just lying. You're just lying so that you don't have to say, yeah, I don't really actually have a point here. You're right. The primary purpose of a gun is to kill people. That's true. You could totally retreat to so many other points that would be better than pretending that the primary purpose of guns is to shoot clay pigeons. But that's what this person did because they didn't have anywhere else to go in the argument at that point. Once they had already argued that the primary purpose of a gun is not to kill, they sort of painted themselves into a corner where they didn't have any way of defending what they were saying. So they just started to pretend to believe things that they know aren't true. They know the primary purpose of guns is not to shoot clay pigeons, but they will pretend that that is the primary purpose so that they don't have to change their position. This is kind of tied to, again, what we talked about on the podcast last week with self-reflection, that an ability to self-reflect affords you the ability to shift your position when presented with new information. An inability to self-reflect means that you'll have a really hard time adjusting even when your position is clearly beat. And this is the same thing that I see happening when I see pro-Israeli counter-demonstrators calling anyone who believes that what's happening in Gaza is a genocide and believes that murdering children is bad and believes that bombing hospitals is bad, calling anyone who holds those positions a terrorist, that's something that you do when you're painted into an ideological corner and you don't have defensible positions. You're not being intellectually honest at that point. You're being intentionally disingenuous. You are adopting a belief that you don't actually really believe in so that you don't have to adjust, so that you don't have to yield and say, okay, all right, you know what? I can accept that not everyone who thinks that bombing hospitals is bad thinks that because they're a terrorist. You say everyone at these protests is a terrorist so that you can justify not having to sympathize with these people, not having to humanize these people, not having to listen to what these people are actually saying. You don't want to have to make an adjustment, so you create a fake narrative that is so obviously disingenuous, that is so obviously incorrect, just so that you don't have to adjust. Because adjusting feels like betraying your identity. It's something that's so primal and so linked to who you are. So you sort of, whether you're doing it consciously or unconsciously, you create these things to hold on to so that you don't have to make a change. And yeah, I don't know, I guess I could call that another bad take, is just people who call, you know, pro-Palestine demonstrators and anti-genocide demonstrators terrorists. Like, that's not true. You know it's not true. That's, some part of you knows that you're lying when you say that, and you're just saying it so that you don't have to yield any ground. I think it's disingenuous, lazy, and pretty fucking ignorant. Okay, moving down the list. Y'all, I'm about to blow your minds right here. This is not the first time that I've done this on this show. We have a surprisingly good take. I've done this before because I am fair and I am balanced, and I am not above agreeing with people who I think are abhorrent and people who I think have terrible ideas and terrible opinions most of the time. There have been a few times on this show where I've been doing a rundown of bad takes, and I've come across a surprisingly good take from someone who I 99% of the time think is awful. I literally, while I was putting this episode together, I went to Tim Pool and Matt Walsh to find some bad takes, because those guys are always just a goldmine of bad takes. On any given week, you're gonna find a bad take on Tim Pool's Twitter page and on Matt Walsh's Twitter page. And I was almost certain that they would have some dog shit terrible take about the protests on college campuses, or on, I don't know, something on, you know, the Supreme Court, with, you know, reproductive health care and stuff like that. I was sure I would find something. I was not expecting to find this. I had to reread it several times because I was like, am I reading this correctly? And then I just had to go, you know what? I came here looking for a bad take, and I found something I can't believe I agree with. And this should really show the Zionist crowd out there, the pro-Israel Zionist crowd, just how unpopular you've made yourselves, just how obviously in the wrong the Israeli government and the Israeli military are on the world stage. Matt Walsh tweeted this out. Matt Walsh tweeted this. I can't believe it. He wrote, "The vast majority of Republicans just voted for a bill to criminalize criticisms of the Israeli government. If the bill passes, you will be guilty of hate speech if you apply double standards to the government of Israel or accuse it of genocide. This is honestly one of the most insane pieces of legislation I've ever seen." Y'all, Matt, what is a woman, Walsh, wrote that. Matt Walsh, Matt Daily Wire, Ben Shapiro's best friend, Walsh, wrote that. That's insane. I didn't know Matt. And guess who retweeted it? Tim Pool. Tim Terrible Hat Pool. Tim never has a good take, never has a good thing to say ever. Pool retweeted that. So apparently, the pro-Zionist position and the pro-Israeli government position has gotten so toxic, it's become so apparent to everyone on the world stage, that even Matt Walsh and even Tim Pool are like, yeah, you guys are doing genocide. Like, I know that early on, Tim Pool was trying to make arguments about how the Israeli government is not committing genocide and how what they're doing is different, but he just retweeted that. Apparently, he thinks it's pretty wild, and maybe it's literally just that they're First Amendment purists, and they're like, oh, we don't think Israel is committing a genocide, but we think you should be allowed to say that. You shouldn't be charged with a crime for saying that. You shouldn't be charged, you know, it shouldn't be hate speech to say that, and maybe it's just that, but it's so shocking, because typically, the MO for guys like Matt Walsh and guys like Tim Pool and guys like Ben Shapiro is, take the opposite position of whatever people on the left are saying, no matter what. It doesn't matter if people on the left are saying we need to defend the Second Amendment with all of our, we just, at all costs, we need to take the opposite position. It's that Key and Peele sketch, from back in the day in the Obama administration, where they have President Obama in like a situation room with a bunch of Republicans in Congress, and he just says the opposite of all of the things that he wants, so that Congress will do what he actually wants, because they're just going to do the opposite of whatever he says. That's typically the MO for guys like Matt Walsh and Tim Pool. So it's wild that. It's crazy that Israel's behavior is so bad, is so obviously bad, that even Matt Walsh and Tim Pool are like, yeah, they should stop doing that. and we shouldn't be passing laws saying that you can't say what they're doing is bad. Like, that's crazy. That's how out of control this situation is like, Matt Walsh and Tim Pool are on our team about this. And I'm happy to agree with them about this. I have no problem with agreeing with them about this and only this and, you know, almost no other things. But, wild. And it might just be a First Amendment purist stance, but I think that there's more to it than that. I think that if this was, because Matt Walsh and Tim Pool are hypocrites when it comes to First Amendment all the time. They have no problem with people they don't like being censored. They're totally okay with that. They do it. They try to get people they don't like deplatformed, canceled, censored all the time. They love to complain about cancel culture and about people who don't support free speech and simultaneously do everything that they can to silence people that they don't agree with. So they have no problem being hypocrites when it comes to the First Amendment. I genuinely think this has to do with Matt Walsh and Tim Pool being aware that what is happening in the world right now is an act of genocide, that it's just undeniable, that you cannot look at the statements from Israeli leaders who are just saying in plain language again and again and again, this is what we're doing, and pretend like that's not what they're doing. Good job, Matt Walsh and Tim Pool, I guess. That's fine. One more thing I want to talk about on the Bad Take Brigade, and then we will go to the comments. It looks like we've been having a really lively conversation in the chat on both TikTok and YouTube. So thank you for doing that. Sarjay Haynes says it's Darvo. And I think that they were referring to the Zionist pro-Israeli counter-protesters who will do the deflecting, attacking, and reverse victim offender thing. Absolutely, there's a lot of Darvo going on in there. And there's people who are having a really lively conversation over here on TikTok as well. So thanks everybody for participating. I got one more thing I want to talk about, and it's sort of not, this one's a little easier. So we talked about a lot of heavy stuff. There's a lot of heavy shit going on in the world. This one's going to take it from the macro sociopolitical, really heavy realm and take it more to the interpersonal social realm. Okay. This one is sort of a, piggyback to the episode of this podcast called Attachment that I did a few weeks ago with Ricky Close, where we talked about different modes of attachment and different attachment styles. And in that episode, I was talking about how like what kind of attachment style is it if I have a lot of friends who accuse me of being bad at texting a lot, but if I feel like my expectations around texting are different than theirs. And we had a long conversation about attachment styles and anxiety with friends about that. But I had a conversation about this with a friend recently, and it made me realize something. So the last people on the Bad Take Brigade today are people who accuse you of being bad at texting or a bad friend if you don't text them back immediately. If it takes you 20 minutes, 30 minutes, even up to a couple hours to write back. And that happens, you know, 5 or 6 times over the course of 6 months. And because of that, that person tells you, you know what, you're bad at texting back. And you're I feel like you don't really value this friendship as much as I do because you don't write back. I've gotten that feedback several times in my life because I just wasn't responding to something that someone sent me immediately. And it's always rubbed me the wrong way. It's never sat right with me because I don't leave people permanently on red very often. It doesn't usually happen. I always do get back to people when I have a free minute. I always make sure I sit down and respond to whatever it is that they sent me. It just doesn't always happen immediately. And there's a lot of reasons for that. The reason why this has always rubbed me the wrong way is I'm like, yeah, sometimes I'm just driving and I'm gonna be in the car for like the next 45 minutes. And I have to hope that I will remember to write this person back once I get out of the car. But by then, like, it might just slip my mind and it might be later that evening when I realize, oh shit, I never wrote them back. And then I do it. And by then it's been like 3 hours, 4 hours, but I do get back to them. Or sometimes I'm at lunch with somebody and I'm physically with another person. And I think it would be rude to pull my phone out and say, sorry, I need to write this person back right now. So it's always sort of rubbed me the wrong way when people bring this up to me. I think it would be one thing if I was just always leaving people on red and never responding to them. I think that's one level of just sort of disregarding people and disrespecting people. But that's not my experience of what's happening on my end in these relationships. I mean, even recently, someone that I was dating, who I'm not dating anymore, who always accused me of being bad at texting because I didn't write back immediately, sent me this TikTok, and she said, LOL, this is you. And the TikTok was this video of the Tennessee Titans locker room, and they were going to all the players and they were asking them, how many unread text messages do you have on your phone right now? And it was sort of this like embarrassing thing where they had to be like, oh geez, don't ask me that question. And then one guy would have like, I got 76 unread text messages. And one guy would be like, I have 342 unread text messages. And one guy had like 1,032 unread text messages in his phone. And she was like, LOL, this is you. And I responded and I was like, yeah, funny. But the thing is, it's literally not, because do you want to know how many unread text messages I have on my phone right now? It's zero. And it's usually zero. Usually the most unread text messages and unresponded text messages I have at any one time is like 4, maybe, and it's always 0 by the end of the day. I've always responded to everyone by the end of the day. So I was like, yeah, this kind of backfired, because you sent me this example of like how I didn't even know that there were people out there in the world who genuinely are walking around with hundreds of unread and unresponded to text messages on their phone. I had no idea that that was even a thing. I've never been that person. And I'm getting accused regularly of like being a bad friend or being inattentive to a relationship because I don't respond immediately. But I was like, it's pretty funny that you sent this to me going, this is you, even though it's literally not. Even though I am the opposite of everyone in that video, I have zero unread and unresponded to text messages on my phone. And that's usually what my phone looks like. And I was kind of griping about this and complaining about this to a friend, and he helped me contextualize why I think that this is a bad take and why I think that this is a bad and unreasonable expectation that people put on other people. And I couldn't believe I'd never thought about this before, but he was so blunt with it. He was like, it's an invasion. It's an interruption and an invasion of your personal space and your personal time and your day. You are going about your day. You are going about your life, handling whatever it is you need to handle. You could be anywhere. You could be, you know, getting screened for jury duty. You could be in a job interview. You could be at work. You could be at a lunch appointment. You could just be in the middle of like writing something you're sort of in a creative, you could be doing whatever. It's your personal time. And we have devices, we have technology where our friends and family have the ability to just insert themselves into the middle of whatever we're doing, no matter where we are, and demand that you stop what you're doing, pay attention to what they just sent you, and respond to it immediately. And it's entirely inappropriate. It's completely unreasonable to expect that that person will just drop whatever it is that they're doing and pay attention to what it is that you sent them. That is not a reasonable expectation, and it's not reasonable or kind or respectful to accuse someone of being a bad friend or inattentive because they didn't stop whatever they were doing and immediately pay attention to you. maybe they were literally with someone else, and it would have been rude to that person and disrespectful to that person if they had stopped to pay attention to you. I don't want to be misunderstood here, because there is a difference between neglecting a relationship, not paying proper attention to a friend, and not, you know, nurturing a relationship properly, ignoring a friend, you know, actually not responding to them and leaving them on read, not doing enough to make sure that friend feels important in your life. There's a difference between that and just being unavailable for a few hours, being somewhere where you can't respond to them in that moment because something else or someone else has scheduled time with you. I think if you need time with a friend, if you need a friend to respond to something, if you need a friend's advice, if you need something from me, you can schedule some time in my life and I will give you that time. If you need to go for coffee or go to lunch and sit down and talk something out, if you want to go watch a movie together, if you just need to talk on the phone, you can reach out and say, hey, are you available to talk? But if it's just, I just had a thought and I just sent it to you in the middle of the day, I have no idea what you're doing. I have no idea where you are. I don't know who you're with. And I just had this thought just popped into my head and I just threw it out to you. And if you don't respond to that within the next 30 minutes, I'm going to think you're a bad friend. You're wrong. You're straight up wrong. You're straight up wrong about that. Pamela Kemper says, why no one thinks it's wrong to ignore the person you are with in real life to reply to a text, hashtag rude. And that's the thing, is that it is rude. It's rude to expect someone to always be immediately available to you and your needs in their day-to-day life. It's rude, and it's self-centered, and it's self-absorbed, and it's really entitled and kind of myopic. And I don't know. I was like, you know what? Yeah, actually, I know that this note keeps coming up with my friendships, that like several people have been like, I don't like that you take too long to respond to me. And I was trying to do all of this like self-examination of like, okay, how can I be better about that? How can I improve on that? And really trying to take inventory and be aware of it. And at the end of the day, I had to be like, no, this note is actually rubbing me the wrong way. And I think it's okay that not every bit of feedback that comes your way has to be correct. I think I get it into my head that like, if someone tells me something they think I need to work on, that is automatically true. That's real, and that person's right. And that's not the case. Sometimes it can be like, I know this from being a content creator, that people offer me feedback all the time that I'm like, no, you're wrong about that. That criticism is incorrect. I disagree. My personal taste is not that. You want me to make the video according to your personal taste. My personal taste says I should do it the way that I did it. And since I'm the one making the video, I did it the way that I did it. And sometimes people offer feedback that I'm like, that's actually good. I like that. And I think it can be the same in your interpersonal relationships. Not every single piece of feedback you get is something that you have to internalize and say, well, geez, if someone's saying it to me, it must be true. There must be some validity to it, because this one never rubbed me the right way. I was always like, I don't know. I think I actually am pretty good at responding to people. I think I'm pretty on top of that. It just sometimes takes a little bit. It takes longer than 30 minutes, you know? And I think that's okay. And it is. That's where I'm at on that, is it is. It is more than okay for someone to not be available to respond to you immediately. My cousin David Allred just said, I find myself saying, hey, sorry for the delay. I haven't had much capacity to reply to messages right now, but I want you to know that I see your message and I'll get back to you as soon as I can. I say that kind of stuff all the time now too, to the people who I know need an immediate response. If I'm available, I'll be like, I'm in a meeting right now. I can't talk. I will try to get back to you soon. Or if I can, I'll really quickly be like, I'm at lunch with somebody. I'll try to catch up with you later. You know, I'll try to let them know that like I see them reaching out. I'm just not available immediately to get back to them, and just let them know that like I see it and I'll get back to it soon. But sometimes that's not even an option. Sometimes it's just like I'm not looking at my phone right now. Like I'm doing something where my phone is in another area of the room, and it's just, it's, I'm not looking at it right now. And that doesn't mean that I'm disrespectful or a bad friend or not nurturing the relationship properly. That just means that I have a life that is separate from yours, and I'm going about my life. So yeah, if you're out there getting really judgmental at people and yelling at people for not responding to your text messages immediately, stop being so self-absorbed and entitled and silly. Let people have their own lives. Also, really, really funny situation. One of my friends who always gets mad at me for not responding immediately, we were having this conversation the other day, and she showed me her phone, and she had like 132 unresponded messages. And I was like, yeah, you just can't. I was like, you can no longer ever say that I'm bad at responding to text messages when you have 132 unread messages on your phone and I have zero. You just can't. You no longer get to do that. And that is kind of, I find that that's actually pretty typical, is like people will, usually people are projecting when they're like, hey, you need to respond faster. It's like, I'm sure, I just think everyone in the modern world sometimes takes a little longer to respond. I really do. I really do. I really think everyone sometimes is not available to respond immediately. I think it's just a reality of the cell phone world that we live in, that we all need to get on board with. Let's see. Jania Green just said on TikTok, as someone with bipolar, the responses sometimes are few and far between. Absolutely. It doesn't always need to be that you're in the car or in a meeting or at lunch or working. Literally, sometimes people just cannot bring themselves to respond. Sometimes I've been in that state where I'm just like, I don't have a way to respond to this right now. And even sending you a message that says, I'm so sorry, I've been a little, I'm not myself right now, my mental health is sort of suffering, even that feels difficult. It feels like a level of vulnerability that I'm not able to access at the moment. And you just got to try to find some basic empathy and just realize that, like, when someone's not getting back to you immediately, there's probably a good reason for it, even if that reason is they just forgot. That's a valid reason. They meant to, they saw your message and they were in the middle of something else and they took a mental note to get back to you and they just forgot, you know? DJ Kento on YouTube says, I screened calls before I had a cell phone too. People got so mad. Sorry, but my time is mine and I choose how I spend it. And that is valid. Valid. It's so valid to go, you actually are not entitled to my time anytime you want it. And that's reasonable. And I am not entitled to yours. My time is mine and I get to choose how I spend it is so valid. And what seems to be inherent in that need to be responded to immediately is this idea that, like, no, your time belongs to me. If you're my friend, you're on my time. You're on my clock. And when I need you, you better fucking respond. And that's, sorry, no, no, absolutely not. No, no. I will say that, I think there's a difference between, you know, why is TikTok doing this? It does this thing lately where it tries to end my lives because there's like no activity, even though like the chat is going wild, even though I'm talking and I'm like, what are you talking about? They're just trying to end my live right now, whatever. Yeah. So I liked that. I was glad that my friend offered me that. Let's see if I missed anything back in the chat when we were talking about protests, when we were talking about, you know, Zionism and Palestine. Okay, why? No internet connection. What are you talking about? Okay, TikTok's gonna boot me off of the live. I have an internet connection. What? Oh my goodness. I hate this app. Everybody, stop following me on TikTok. Follow me on YouTube. TikTok sucks. God, I hate TikTok. And, you know, I still don't think that they should ban it, but it does suck. Okay. let's see. Let's see. Somebody said 49595 said great t-shirt. I have a Purple Rain Prince t-shirt on. Thank you. King Baby says everyone is a full person with their own complete life going on. Yeah, that's it. That's simple. Yeah. Pamplemoose on YouTube says they should ban it for being trash, LOL. I mean, yeah, it is trash. It's the worst. And I wish people understood who follow me on TikTok that everything that you like on TikTok, I do all of that on YouTube and more. I just wish I could instantly teleport everyone that follows me on TikTok over to YouTube. My life would be so much better if I existed in that reality, but I don't. There is some version of me out there that exists in that reality. I'm rewatching Devs right now. Dude, Devs rips. Devs is so fucking good. I love that show. And I even think that there's like some bad acting in it. I kind of think that the girl who's the lead is bad in the whole show. And that's how good the show is I don't care. The show's great. Nick Offerman rips in Devs. Allison Pill rips. Stephen McKinley Henderson rips. Kaylee Spaney rips. But the lead is kind of bad. I can't remember her name, DJ Kento just said Alex Garland is goated, and I think he might be. I have a video coming out on Alex Garland tomorrow on YouTube, where you can't get it on TikTok. A YouTube exclusive video coming out called "You Don't Want This: Lessons from Alex Garland's Civil War," where I break down the movie Civil War. Excited about that, but like, I don't know, dude. I've been going through Alex Garland's filmography, even the early stuff that he just wrote. Dude's pretty solid. I wasn't a big fan of Men, but like, he's got a pretty solid catalog there that he's built. And it's mostly just like built on like good ideas, you know? And Devs is the one that just gets, it just, ooh, it gets my noodle going in such a great way. The first time I watched Devs, I found determinism to be very upsetting and disturbing. And this time I'm watching it, I'm actually finding a lot of comfort in determinism. I'm like, no, yeah, it's cool. I'm just in the reality where all of this stuff is happening. And that's fine. And I don't need to worry about like fixing it or changing it. It just is what it is. And it's all good. Devs rules. Somebody says, just jumped in. Who are we talking about? We're talking about Alex Garland and Devs in particular. Do you like scary shows like Haunting of Hill House? Someone asks. I do. I liked that show a lot. And I like, what's his name? Flaherty, the guy that makes all that stuff. I think that he's good. DJ Kento says the finale of Annihilation is the greatest example of coming to grips with ego death. Really helped me get through some shit. Oh, totally. Every time I watch Annihilation, I'm like, oh, this might be his best movie. Like Annihilation is so sneaky good, so underappreciated in the last 20 years and like sci-fi films. Like it might be one of the top five best sci-fi films of the 21st century. It's dope. Ooh, Elise Tanner just sent me $9.99 in the super chat on YouTube. Thank you so much. Damn. Appreciate you. Love you. And some hearts. How nice. You all can do that, by the way. Super chat is now a thing on YouTube that people can do. Have you seen Oblivion? Yeah, Oblivion's fun. I like Tom Cruise. Oblivion's good. I would not put Oblivion in the top 10 sci-fi films of the 21st century, but I would put Annihilation in there. King Baby, who's transferred over to YouTube because King Baby knows what's up. King Baby said, switched over from TikTok because I'm a real one, and that is the truth. And King Baby says, Screaming Bear haunts me. If you've seen Annihilation and you know what the Screaming Bear is, yeah, incredible, incredible. Obviously, Garland's like, some of his films have been adaptations, you know, Annihilation is an adaptation. Never Let Me Go is an adaptation. I think Ex Machina is an adaptation, or maybe that's an original screenplay, but he still does like a lot of really interesting things with these adapted properties. I will say this. I think Civil War is a very strong film. The more that I think about Civil War and analyze it, and the more when I was making this video for it, the more I'm like, I really wish Civil War had been in the same format as Devs. I think Civil War would have been its best version as an 8-part or 10-part miniseries. I think it's the exact same story. It's four photojournalists on a road trip from New York City to Washington, D.C. to get an interview with the president at the height of a violent modern civil war in America. But in an 8 to 10 episode format, you could really go into the backstory of each four of the four main characters and have episodes where you explore all of their backstories. You could kind of do flashbacks and show the beginning of the war and how the Western forces came to be and really kind of examine you could build the world out more in a really interesting way, because it's a really fascinating cinematic world, and you only get to spend 2 hours in it. And there's a lot of like desire left on the table to know more about this world and about these people. And I think that what he does with the 2 hours that he has is pretty effective. And I think it's a really strong film, and I think it's very worthwhile. But boy, I think it really could have rocked as an 8 to 10 part miniseries. Let's see. Lady Los Productions also switched over and says, on a different angle over here, totally different camera angle over here, more straight on. It's better over here. Yeah, I think that we're kind of... GJ Kenta said, also loved The Beach. Did he write The Beach? I know Danny Boyle directed The Beach, but I don't think Alex Garland wrote The Beach. Was he writing stuff all the way back then? I don't think Alex Garland is as old as Danny Boyle. I think Alex Garland started working with Boyle at 28 Days Later, and then they did Sunshine together. I might be wrong. Maybe Garland wrote The Beach too, but The Beach is a good one. Yeah, I think that's it. I think that we went through the bad takes. We rocked some stuff. We worked through some stuff. Metal Gear Snake 99 says, thoughts on Looper. I'd put Looper in maybe the top 10 sci-fi films of the 21st century. I love Looper. Looper's great. I think the 21st century has been like really doing time travel right. It's been doing time, like Back to the Future is a very fun movie, but it's garbage in terms of like making you think about time travel. It's just nonsense. It's just movie nonsense science that doesn't actually have any real world head scratching applications or philosophical applications. It's just fun. I love the Back to the Future movies, but they're not like, whoa, that's an interesting thing to think about. It's just silly movie nonsense. But like Looper and Arrival and even Interstellar, to a certain degree, are doing things with time travel that are really fun, because it's all about how like time is this fixed circle, this fixed like kind of like line, and you have to do things because that's the way that things unfold, and you have to sort of close the loop on things, and it's this like circular idea of time travel. And Looper definitely has an ending that breaks the timeline off into a new timeline, but I still like the concept of Looper, of like this sort of circular time travel logic. And it's also just like a well-executed fun film to watch. But yeah, gosh, if I had to pick top 10 sci-fi films of the 21st century, I'd probably put Dune 1 and 2 in there somewhere, and maybe we just put those as one film. Annihilation, Looper can go in there, Interstellar, Arrival. Trying to think. District 9, that's a good one. Somebody just said District 9 in the comments. That's a good one for sure. Blomkamp's other movies have been kind of disappointing, but District 9 was good. Elysium was fine. Somebody said Primer. I've never been a fan of that guy's movies. I'll be honest. I get why people like him. It's impressive that he does what he does with as little as he has. Shane Carruth, I think is his name. Shane Carruth, who made Primer and Upstream Color. I just don't think that they're like well-made enough films. Like I can't get into them because they sort of sit behind this like there's a barrier of like, I can't hear what anyone's saying. And he writes in such an abstract way that it's really hard for me to just like sit down and enjoy the film. And so I don't know. I have a hard time just enjoying watching Shane Carruth's movies because he seems to sort of be concealing them behind this layer of like pretension or something that I don't know that I can't get in there the way that I want to get in there. DJ Kento says, I don't want the movie to be homework. Primer isn't fun. I agree. King Baby says, any Denis Villeneuve. Yeah, I mean, I'd put Blade Runner 2049 in there for sure. Villeneuve, I'm working on a video essay right now called Denis Villeneuve is the Chosen One, about how Denis Villeneuve is like the Lisan al-Gaib of film. Like, there have been many suitors who have stepped up in the last 25 years to be like the new Spielberg, the new Scorsese, you know, the new, you know, Sidney Lumet. There's a lot of these like auteur guys, Damien Chazelle, Alex Garland, Christopher Nolan, all these people who have sort of stepped up to try to fill this slot. And I think that it's Villeneuve. I think that Denis Villeneuve is the guy who's like actually elevating everything to another level and who is actually like not missing, who his movies, he doesn't have a stinker in the bunch. He's just constantly hitting it out of the park and elevating, like demanding that everybody else get on his level. So I'm evaluating his filmography right now, and I'm going through his films, and like every time I watch a Denis movie, I'm just like, this is the guy. This is, dude, he's the guy. But I also, man, I'm really impressed with Garland's movies as I've been going through the stuff that he's made as well. Okay, cool thing. What about Inception? Somebody asks. Metal Gear Snake asks, what about Inception? Do you think that would make top 10? Probably. Inception, the older I get and the more time passes, the more I love and am impressed by Inception. I remember when it first came out thinking like, like I sort of agreed with that South Park episode that makes fun of it and how it's just sort of like, he's pretending that this idea is really heady and deep and cool when really it's not. He's just using like big sound effects and action sequences to trick the audience into thinking that the movie is more complex than it is. And I think that that's actually not true. I think that that's like a kind of cynical, overly simplistic evaluation of what that film is. I think that that movie just like, it is kind of a simple concept, but it's so well executed. And that's where Nolan movies succeed for me, is in execution. Really, that's where they succeed or die for me, is in execution. Because I always think his movies are playing with fun ideas, and sometimes I think the execution leaves something to be desired. And that's why I wouldn't put Nolan on Villeneuve's level, because I think sometimes the idea for the film is better than the film itself. Dunkirk is a great example of that, where like the idea is cool, but the execution leaves a lot to be desired. Tenet is a great example of that. The idea is really cool. Again, 21st century movies doing really interesting things with time travel. The idea of it being a reversal of entropy, a machine that reverses a person or an object's entropy. That's really, really fascinating and interesting, that you're not really arriving at a different point in time. You're just moving backwards through time at a regular pace, is really, really fascinating. The movie has frustrating aspects of its execution. It's really hard to hear, as are a lot of Christopher Nolan movies. I think Oppenheimer leaves a lot to be desired in the execution of the film and the construction of the edit. But movies like Inception and The Prestige and The Dark Knight are so well constructed that they really, really work. And you've got the good idea and the construction that all really works. Inception is maybe one of his very best, like that or Interstellar or The Prestige, because it's got everything working for it. And yeah, Inception's great. It's such a simple concept. It's like, it seems actually complex because it's like, well, these people are dream, you know, they invade people's dreams and they plant ideas in their dreams. But really what it is, it's a story about a guy who lost his wife and he can't deal with reality, and he's hiding from his pain in his subconscious, and he's running from his pain in his dreams and in his subconscious. So the whole movie takes place in a dream world because he's running from grief inside this dream world. And that's why the whole movie has this weird feeling to it, where you're like following along this internal logic. And the second the movie ends, you're like, I'm not sure if any of that made any sense. And because it's a dream, because that's how a dream is. While you're watching the movie, you're going, yeah, okay. Yeah, he's got to run from that guy because that guy is going to get him. And you got to get down, just duck down. Those people are shooting at you. And okay, you got to go plant the thing and that thing. And then you wake up and you're like, I don't know who any of those people were that I was running from in the dream. And I don't know why it was so important that I put that thing on the thing. And I'm not really sure what just happened. And that's how Inception is, and it's pretty fucking cool to execute that cinematically, to be like, to make a movie that feels the way a dream feels, and it's a movie about a man who is hiding from grief in his dreams. Pretty cool. Pretty cool. Love it. Okay. All right, that's it. Good conversation. Thank you for the feedback in the comments. We got talking about movies there at the end somehow, and I'm not mad about it. It's fine. It's all good. We can talk about whatever we want to on this show, okay? Because People Pleaser is written, edited, hosted, and produced by me, Austin Archer. And it's got original theme music also by me. You can find more of my music by going to austin-archer.com, austinarchermusic.bandcamp.com, or by just looking up Austin Archer on Spotify or Apple Music. I've got my double vinyl for sale over at my Bandcamp. You can get that if you're into vinyl. That's a cool thing that you can have. Patreon.com/Austin Archer is a place that you can support this show and all the things that I do. And I love the people who support me over there. Shout out to my Patreon patrons. You are the realest ones and my favorite people. You're the kindest people, the most generous people. Thank you for what you do. Yeah. Check me out on YouTube, y'all. It's getting real over there. Go subscribe. Okay, that's it. Be careful out there. Be safe. Take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. We'll see you at the next one. Love you so much, and bye-bye. The insensitive should only mean that I'm in touch with my emotions. Shouldn't mean that I take everything way too personally. Being self-absorbed should mean that I got passion and devotion. And being self-righteous should mean I got a great self-esteem.